way that I would surmise it is that Africa has a lot of arable land, and arable land is a natural resource. And so if Africa wants to become more wealthy, it needs to utilize its natural resources, whether they be its arable land, its mineral resources, etc., to the benefit of society.
Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Onwokolo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Food imports to sub-Saharan Africa exceed $25 billion annually. Yet, over 60% of sub-Saharan Africa's population is estimated to consist of smallholder farmers, and some 23% of the region's GDP comes from agriculture. Estimates also suggest that Africa could produce 2 to 3 times more cereals and grains, adding 20% to the global output. Africa has some 874 million hectares of arable farmland, an estimated 60% of the world's total. However, the continent uses only 43% of this arable land and with rain-fed potential. Agriculture here in Africa is relatively unmechanized. Its farmers have only one tractor per 868 hectares compared to the global average of one per 56 hectares. Barriers to the realization of the continent's much acclaimed potential in agriculture are quite clear. A lack of resources such as fertilizer, improved seeds, adequate storage technology and transportation services, as well as war instability, lack of clarity about land titles, low investment in people and management systems, government meddling in food prices, and the absence of economies of scale and technology. With some 600 million people engaged directly or indirectly in agricultural production in Africa, an estimated 65 to 70% of whom are women, improved performance can spread the benefits of economic growth to a marginalized section of the population as well. What are the options that we have? Today's chat will highlight a young African and his spirited colleagues, of course, who have chosen to stand in the gap in the oil palm sector in Nigeria as an example. Given the fragmented supply chain, Relief, an agriculture technology company that develops hardware and software solutions to drive industrialization of food processing in Africa, is innovating around ways to reduce costs and increase value by streamlining and expanding distribution, and to improve farmer revenues by ensuring and broadening market access. Today, I caught up with co-founder and CEO Iken Nainzewi. Ikenna graduated from Yale University in 2017 with a bachelor's in computer science and co-founded Relief while he was still at university. In the early days of Relief, Ikenna also worked as an associate consultant at Bain & Company, one of the biggest management consultant firms in the world, as part of the private equity group conducting commercial due diligence for leading global private equity funds with assets under management exceeding $400 billion. I could tell you about the Relief story with my croaky voice today, but why hear it from me? Join me in the chat with Ikenna. So today we'll be speaking at a granular level with Ikenna, although not about grains, but nuts. Yes, let's just pretend I didn't say all of that. Ikenna, welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I am very well. So I think it fits quite well that it's still morning where you are. So I just thought, you know, we can play a little game to warm us up. It's just, you know, a short game to familiarize the audience with who you are. Are you ready?
Yes, okay. I am.
What was the first job on your resume?
Soccer referee.
No way. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that is so interesting. Okay, I'd like to hear more about that some other time. Yeah. How many languages do you speak?
Two. English and Spanish.
Oh, Spanish. Oh, that's cool. Okay. It's different. All right. Do you have any hobbies or skills that people don't know about? I guess I can say the public don't know about.
I really enjoy pottery. It's a hobby I picked up in my last year of university. And one that I'm trying to get more serious about.
Yeah. Oh, that's super cool. What best describes your work day, if there's any such thing?
So my days have themes. So on specific days, I do certain types of work. So for example, on Thursdays, I take lots of meetings with external parties. On Tuesdays, I take meetings with internal parties. And then on Wednesdays, I do like very deep work days and just work on like a big project.
Oh, that is cool. I think I heard that once by, I don't know if you're familiar with like Jay Shetty, but this idea of like basically deciding, you know, there are specific days that you do specific things. I think it's pretty cool. It might be a lot easier to do when you're sort of in charge, but no, it's definitely is. I think it's an interesting concept that I don't know that a lot of us do. Maybe we should take a page or two from your book. Are you a zero inbox person, again?
I am a zero inbox person. Oh, really? Yeah.
So we will not see 4,284 emails in your inbox. On red.
Why did that number come to mind? No.
Just, I actually don't know where it came from. Okay. And I'm a zero inbox person myself, so I don't know how people do it, but I'm like, wow.
Not you either, huh?
Yeah, no, definitely I can't. My inbox is my to-do list. It's kind of weird, so I just get through everything. But yeah, anyway, what is one skill that you underestimated but has served you really well in your work?
I would say my ability to go to like more rural areas and be more an adventurer, someone who can ask for directions anywhere they go and just feels comfortable like learning from the crowd and trusting like the crowd's background.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty. And I'm sure that was quite helpful when you were doing your field research in Nigeria when you decided to start Relief.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a big part of our success.
Yeah, no, definitely. What was their last aha moment that you had and what was that about?
One of the big aha moments that I had recently been thinking about Africa's food processing sector. Is that we need more industry cartography. And what I mean by that is a cartographer is someone who makes maps. And we need to decide where we place food processing assets to best create like an efficient food processing system. In food processing, you have to worry about a lot of weight and post-harvest loss. And so where you place these assets is actually really important to create an efficient food system.
No, that's pretty cool. Is that something you are working on doing, advocating for someone else to do, or is that, you know, something you're looking to explore at all?
Yeah, I think that's where we see our future at Relief is being a critical voice in advocating for the placement of different food processing assets in specific locations where they will create the most value for society.
Oh, that's pretty cool. What comes to mind, Ikenna, when you hear or think about Africa in 2050?
Well, I'm Nigerian, and by 2050, we'll be the third most populous country on the planet. So that's certainly what comes to mind first. But yeah, I think in general, there's, you know, the reality of the matter is Africa's population is growing faster than it ever have and faster than it ever will. After around 2050, 2070, you'll start to see our population growth rate decrease and eventually the population will level out. So we're really in the heyday of an opportunity to create a lot of food processing technologies because there is such a strong demographic dividend that's kind of pushing more air behind ourselves.
Okay. I was about to ask if
you know, this statistic scared you, encouraged you, but I heard you use the word opportunity in there. So I think I know where you stand on that front. Anyway, that's the end of the quick game. It's really just a chance to get sort of, I guess, more familiar with your thought process, certain things about you. Like, we learned you like pottery. I didn't see that anywhere in my due diligence. So thank you very much. But thanks so much for engaging in this one. So I'll get straight to business because I also want to be respectful of your time. So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what is the problem, right, or set of problems or issues that relief exists to address, and how did you get wrapped up in this?
Yeah, I think the primary challenge that we're trying to solve is that Africa's food processing system is really, it's really nascent. There's in actuality just an industry to be built that is a fundamental industry for society. And we're really excited to be the technology company that catalyzes Africa's food processing future. So that's where we see ourselves and the challenge that we're solving.
Awesome. And how did you get into the space or wrapped up in the space where the idea for Relief come from?
Yeah, so Relief started as a nonprofit when I was in my third year of university. Hmm. When we started the organization, I had never been back to the continent. My parents both grew up in Nigeria, but moved to the United States, and we never went home when I was a kid. So there was always a longing to return to the continent. Mm-hmm. And I created Relief as a means to get more Africans in the diaspora involved in Africa's agricultural future.
I see.
And so I was able to travel back to Nigeria for the first time. And from there, I just felt like I had found my life's work. It just seemed like the right fit for my background. And even though I had a lot to learn, I don't have any like food or agricultural background. It just seemed to be an immense opportunity to work on. And so I was fortunate to have co-founders who were also very intelligent and adventurous people. And I think we all pushed each other to take the next daring step many times, and then found ourselves in very interesting corners and pockets of rural Nigeria trading different agricultural commodities. So I definitely say there was some really positive peer pressure that informed the formation of this business. And I'm glad that we're all safe and live to tell the story.
Yeah, well, that's excellent. And I don't think I knew this about the story, but I appreciate, you know, the fact that it started out not necessarily as, you know, you were starting like this business, but it was really a way to get people connected back home. I think that's pretty, like, that's unique. And so, yeah, I guess thanks for following the design, the instincts on that, because look what you built out of that. One thing I wanted to ask though is, so this idea of agriculture, and I'm sure a lot of this came from sort of the initial visits to Nigeria, but the idea that agriculture plays a key role, right, in African economies and has the potential to sort of, you know, reshape the continent. And I was just wondering, we hear a lot of that in one way or the other. Can you share a little bit about, you know, how exactly agriculture can be this sort of, you know, revolutionizing force or revolutionary force, and rather, which empowers African economies, and the effect it has on the lives of the average, like, smallholder farmer? How does it create that effect for the actual people involved?
The way that I would surmise it is that Africa has a lot of arable land, and arable land is a natural resource. And so if Africa wants to become more wealthy, it needs to utilize its natural resources, whether they be its arable land, its mineral resources, et cetera, to the benefit of society. So the agriculture that we see today is an employer of, it generally has plurality. It's the biggest employer within most sub-Saharan African countries. But the style of agricultural production and processing and retailing is still at a very nascent stage, with a number of people participating in agriculture at more of a subsistence level than as a real form of business. And so I still feel that there is a large degree of non-consumption of our arable land as a natural resource, and a lot of underutilization of land that is primarily being used in subsistence farming. And so there's a big opportunity to just get good at agriculture, get good at food processing. Yeah. And I think that it requires a lengthy time investment. You know, we're talking on the order of 20, 30 years. But there is quite a bit of precedent around the world, especially in East and Southeast Asia, of countries being able to radically improve the livelihoods of their populace by helping smallholder farmers increase their yields, by providing machinery for agro-processing and creating export-oriented markets. And so we see those three areas as really like the building blocks for a 21st century society. And we want to play an integral role in catalyzing that.
And I mean, so agriculture, you know, as we know, it is something that has been, you know, in existence since, I don't know, time immemorial. How would you say, at least over the years that you've been involved in this, over the years you've researched, that agriculture has evolved or changed, especially on the continent, or you can speak specifically, I guess, to Nigeria? Has it evolved at all? Where does it need to be?
Yeah, I think the evolution of agriculture is not the easiest thing to track with your own two eyes. You have to be at a pretty macro level, especially if one's giving commentary on the region. Our focus is specifically within Nigeria's sustainable oil palm sector. And we've seen a lot of investment by smallholder farmers, as well as like small-time plantations. We've seen a shift towards improved yields. And we're seeing that demand for these products is just completely outstripping supply. So there's still a really great opportunity for investment in Nigeria's oil palm sector. Like I said, our population is doubling over the next 30 years in Nigeria, adding 200 million heads. And so that requires that, you know, production continue to increase. So I think the demographic dividend is creating a really interesting opportunity for more commercial agricultural production.
Yeah,
I also think that will lead to more commercialized and primary food processing, which is really the piece of the puzzle where relief fits in.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And earlier you mentioned sort of, you know, I guess a bit of the technical element that is needed to support, you know, like farmers or farming. And I was just wondering, are the issues in, I guess, with agriculture and perhaps specifically to oil palm, as you mentioned, are they primarily technical? Is that the biggest challenge that you would say the sector faces, or is it multifaceted? Is it just two things, or is it more than that, i.e. is it political?
Yeah, it's multifaceted. I think the primary two issues are access to capital and technical know-how of where to position a factory and what to invest in during the first phase of a factory's development. A lot of people run into a following scenario, right? So they need, let's say they need $100 to create a strong and viable factory, right?
Yeah.
They have an issue with access to capital, so they only have $75, right? So already they're going to be, you know, cutting corners and trying to figure things out, but they don't have the full amount of capital that they would need to properly roll out the factory.
Right.
Then you couple that with the entrepreneur choosing the wrong location for the factory. Oftentimes, most entrepreneurs will site factories where their family is from or where they have land, and that might not be the best location relative to the raw material or the markets for those products. And then third, the person may take that $75 and sit down with the feasibility study and see that if they add three stages of value to the crop, then they'll make a huge profit margin, right? And so they'll invest at $75 in doing three stages of value addition. But the issue is that all three of those stages are different. They have their own issues and peculiarities. And so you end up in a situation where a factory doesn't have the amount of capital that was needed to set itself up properly. It's in the wrong location. And the business owner has taken on too much operational complexity to be excellent at any of the three stages that they're operating in. And that leads to factories that like start up, they operate for a little bit, the proprietor doesn't make money, and they end up shutting down the factory and selling the parts to other people. And so our belief is that the industry needs like a cartographer. Like we need to say, hey, these are the locations where these factories should be located so that they make the most profitability and reduce the amount of logistics that are needed, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. Then this is the amount of money that you actually need to start this factory. Don't start the factory with $75. You actually need $100 to be successful. And then this is the stage of value addition that you should start with first. Just because you start with one stage of value addition does not mean that you cannot move to the second or third in the future. But early wins and successes are very important to catalyze investment in this space. And so an entrepreneur needs to be very, very specific and particular about what they choose to start with instead of kind of viewing the start as the end and trying to do everything at once.
No, that's helpful. One thing that just came to mind when you were speaking. So in terms, you do a lot of work with farmers, and I'm just wondering, how is, you know, sort of this use of like tech and all these, not necessarily new ways of doing, perhaps improved or better ways of doing things. And I'm sure you learn from farmers as well, but how is this message often received, especially, and I'm speaking purely as, you know, a continent, also West African child, not child per se, but I think in the context of the question we're about to ask, it will make sense. But how is this often received by people who have been doing this for years, for decades, when you go to interact with them on some of these, you know, new ways of doing things, better ways of doing things?
Yeah, definitely. So within our value chain, smallholder farmers use very rudimentary tools to process their palm nuts, to basically crack open these nuts. They'll use like handheld rocks. They'll use very, very rudimentary little machines. But it yields, it creates a lot of post-harvest loss. So in our value chain in Nigeria, it's very uncommon for anybody else to crack the nuts than the farmers. The farmers usually crack the nuts and then they sell them to traders and traders sell them to factories. And so our solution was quite a new one because the farmers are used to doing the nut cracking and then selling the kernels, not the nuts themselves. So, I mean, I think innovation is actually the same with people all over the world. Most people are not interested in a solution when it's new. There generally is an early adopter that can be identified. And your objective as a business is to make your early adopters as successful as possible.
Right.
And more people will be willing to adopt your technological solutions. So when we're tripling the incomes of the smallholder farmers we're working with by buying their nuts and providing financing to them, that creates the early adopter success case that gets other people excited. So I think a level of patience is required. Smallholder farmers are, they're often very vulnerable communities. And a lot of us folks with a lot more privilege often go to farmers and ask them to kind of risk it all on our new idea. So I think a level of humility is required from our end because when you're dealing with folks that, you know, if they mess up 1 year, it could have material impacts on their family. So creating means through which they can pilot a technology without making themselves more vulnerable is a really important problem for an innovator to solve.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think it's a very important point of understanding sort of the risk that they are taking as well. Because I remember having a conversation with someone about something like that, and it was like, well, I mean, and it wasn't to do with farming, but it was like, well, things have changed, and it's either we get on board, and I'm just like, there's a little, not even sympathy, but just put yourself in the other person's shoes to realize that, yes, these things are great, but for some people, it's a huge risk, and it's uncomfortable, so it will take some time. So, yeah, thank you for acknowledging that. Okay, lastly, what has been your sort of biggest success so far?
Our biggest success is the team that we've built and the culture that we have at Relief. I feel that our team is capable and has proven that it is capable of handling so many different types of challenges, whether they be financial, strategic, regulatory, technological risk, et cetera, et cetera. I think we've just built a doing organization and a company culture that is very open and friendly, but orients itself around achieving things in real life. So we have a mandate, and our mandate is to industrialize food processing in Africa. And we use the word mandate instead of mission because we think that word demonstrates our seriousness in actually achieving this ambition, as opposed to it being like sort of, you know, like a poster on the wall that we all agree would be a nice aspirational goal. So yeah, I would say our team is the thing I'm most proud of, and it's been a real blessing and an opportunity to be a steward of this company and its path.
Thank you for sharing that. And if I may ask, I know you mentioned like, you know, requiring some people to help in mapping, but is there any other, or is it just that really, let's say next 5 to 10 years, thinking of what you're hoping to achieve, like where does the biggest challenge remain and what do you need to address that? And cartographers could be one of those.
Yeah, so I think at a high level, just describe it as we aim to be the foremost technology and financial company in accelerating Africa's industrialization. So that means inventing novel pieces of technology for factories, like physical pieces of machinery. But it also means providing software on where to put factories and raising different financial instruments to basically help get those machines on ground in those places that we've decided. So we see ourselves as a catalyst for industry. We catalyze industry by first doing things ourselves. So we invent the piece of technology, we set it up where we think it should be, we operate it ourselves, and we show the market that there is a lot of potential in Africans inventing their own technologies and using them to process their own crops. Like, who would have thought that that would be the case, except everyone else on the planet who's done the exact same thing for their crops and their plants, right? So that's where we see ourselves positioned, is let's develop the technology that we require for our economic development. And Relief wants to be the catalyst that brings that stuff to fruition.
Amazing, and such a good note to end this. Ikenna, thank you so much for granting me the space. I've sort of been super interested in Relief since the first time I heard about this at the Harambe Summit, actually, in 2020. So thank you for having this chat with me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was really, really great to have this conversation with you too. And I guess the secret is out of the bag on my pottery obsession now, but hopefully, it won't go too far.
We're putting it out there. So I'm not sure how people will deal with it, but hey, we had it first, guys. All right. Thanks so much, Ikenna.
Awesome.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website, www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org, for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.